Okay, tonight's topic is called Hanukkah, winter and time. And in order to understand Hanukkah, we have to review something we've spoken about here many times before, which is the nature of Jewish holidays. Because it's really quite different than the nations of the world and the way they have holidays. They have holidays that are commemorations of something that once happened. Independence Day commemorates the day that they signed the Declaration of Independence. That's a nice thing. Thanksgiving, in theory, commemorates the arrival of the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock, but that's not accurate. And the proof is that it was always in October until the Lincoln administration, and they moved it to November to artificially create a holiday season in America. And certainly Mother's Day and Father's Day, which are simply a commercial effort created by the Hallmark Company, they are obviously, they're not even commemorations. They're just random. But the Jewish world view, our concept of time is very different than that, because Rav Dessler, or Eliyahu Dessler, who was a great thinker of the middle 20th century, in his writings it says that every one of the holidays, when we come back to that holiday, it's really just every Shavuos is all one Shavuos. Every Pesach is all one Pesach. You come back to a time of the year that has a spiritual character. I'll go a step further than saying a spiritual character. It has a it has in its time a potential that is found specifically in that time that makes that time usable for something specific. And let's look at the natural world to understand this. I don't know anything about farming, nothing at all. But I do know this, that different crops are planted at different times of the year. I couldn't tell you which ones when. I know there's something called winter wheat and there's something called spring wheat. Spring wheat is obviously, must be planted sometime, or harvested. For that matter, I don't know if it's harvested, I don't know. I think it's planted sometime in the spring. Winter wheat sometime in the winter. They figured out that this particular type of plant, though you could plant it in May, June, July, August, September, October, it is sensible to plant it, it is most appropriate, most apt, most successful to plant it in December, or whenever they plant winter wheat. But before, this is the important point. It's possible at times, but there's a unique set of physical circumstances that make it work this time of year better than other times of year. Yeah? We all agree about that? If you want to get a suntan and you live in New York, so, you know, there's a reason why bathing suits are less expensive probably in October than they were in May. They're on sale. We got to get rid of them. If you want to go to suntan, there's an appropriate time. It's possible any time of year. But it's much easier in June, July, August than it would be in December, January, and February. The thing about the winter wheat, going back to the winter wheat, is that before they realized, before whoever it has discovered that this particular plant makes sense for this particular time, even before they ever made that discovery, it was already true. Meaning that particular semolina was always appropriate to plant that time of year. It's only that the scientists figured that out. But that time of the year had those physical properties all along. Then they figured it out. And so now they do it like that. The same thing is true exactly in the spiritual realm. In the spiritual realm, the time of year has particular properties. See, we're here together now on a very auspicious time. It's the seventh night of Hanukkah, and it's Rosh Chodesh. Today is the first day of the month of Teves. These have spiritual properties. We need to understand what those spiritual properties are. But there's a spiritual date here that's real. real. Right now, it's the first of Tevis. That means that 4 hours ago, when it was the 30th of Kislev, it was different. Kislev was different. Tevis is different. It has different properties. Every day of the Jewish year has properties. Some of them we can easily tell what they are. The way we can tell what they are is from major historical events that came and testified to their potential. It's not a coincidence that terrible things have happened to the Jewish people at many different times in history on Tisha B'Av. Many times. The spies came back with their bad report in the desert. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The Jews were expelled out of Spain on that day. I'll say something controversial. The expulsion of the Jews from Gush Katif, from Gaza, happened in the 9 days. Right there, in about 4 days before Tisha B'Av, something like that. These bad things happen that time of year. When we come back to that time again, we're not merely commemorating like the way the nations of the world commemorate. We're not just saying, well, you know what, today's an appropriate day for, we're commemorating Independence Day, but not, when they commemorate Independence Day, is there now independence in the air? No. They don't shoot off firecrackers because July 4th's properties speak to that the work to do is firecrackers. No, nothing like that. If they would move it, they'd move. They could move it. Sometimes they do move it to observed on this day, whatever. You know, these kinds of things. On July 4th, they happen not to, but other things they do. When they got rid of president, they used to have, when I was a little kid, they had Washington's birthday and they had Lincoln's birthday. Now they have President's Day.
January and February.
Right. So, what happened to the properties of what Washington's birthday was? Well, that was never anything real anyway. And certainly, if you see, they move Thanksgiving from here to there. But by us, it's totally different. Havdol, to separate from the mundane to the spiritual, to the mundane to the real. When you come to a Jewish holiday, you're coming back to a time that you can accomplish certain things, that your relationship with Hashem demands certain things from you so that you can connect in a way that this type of year gives you that opportunity. And so, one question I want to ask in a minute is what are the properties of Hanukkah? What are we doing here? But I just want to illustrate this point in one more sort of what I think is a poignant idea. When the Torah tells us that the angels came to Avraham to report that he was going to have a son, and they came to see if he was doing well, and they came to declare that there was going to be destruction of Sodom, this is all in the beginning of Parshas Vayera. After they left Avraham, they went to Lot, Avraham's nephew. And there in the Pasuk, in the verse, it says, do you remember what Lot serves them? Hey, do you have any idea what food serves them? What food? Matzah! Exactly, very good, Anna. It says, "Umatzos afa," and he baked matzahs for them.
Before Passover, or before the...
Well, that's
before
all
they made matzah.
It says, they said he baked matzahs.
Yeah, before they left Egypt. Yeah.
So comes Rashi with a two-word cryptic Rashi. On the words, "Matzos afa," Rashi says, "Pesach haya." It was Pesach, it was Passover. It's ridiculous. On the surface, that is preposterous. This is to the day 401 years before the Exodus. Sorry, you're being attacked by that bug. So, to the day, this is 401 years before. It's a preposterous notion that Lot was baking matzahs 401 years before the Jewish people left the land of Egypt quickly. But the answer is this. Somehow, either by his relationship to Avram or his own greatness, he was tuned in to the spiritual frequency of what the time was. And that time was always the right day to bake matzahs. Even before it became revealed to us with the Exodus, with them leaving quickly, the lessons of matzah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is by the way a class for the end of this series, the lessons of matzah, all the way in April. But the lessons of matzah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the master of the universe controls everything and he doesn't need our help, that he can do things quickly. That's always been true. When is the time of year that spiritually speaking, you can most see this? It's always been the 15th of Nisan. It became manifest in the events of Pesach. We can now see it. We have our eyes open. But he had open eyes to it even before it ever happened. He knew what it was. Now in my life, the 17th of Cheshvan keeps coming up as a major day. It's not an event on the Jewish calendar, but it's a major day in my personal life. We were engaged on the 17th of Cheshvan, and both of our first two sons, 2 years apart, were born on the 17th of Cheshvan. I don't know what it means. It's also the day of the flood. The flood, original flood, happened on the 17th of Cheshvan. And the Medrash says, or the Zohar says, that there would have been the giving of the Torah if not for they weren't, didn't deserve it. So something's going on there. I don't know what it means, but I know something's going on. Maybe someday it'll be revealed to me. In the meantime, I don't know. But Lot knew even 401 years before the event happened. So that's the concept of coming back to time that has spiritual character that is unique to that day. And every day has that. And every day has a nuance of that. Today is not yesterday, and tomorrow is not today. Today is the first day of Teves and the seventh day of Hanukkah. That has a unique character. Now that's beyond me. I can speak a little to the character of Hanukkah in general. And a different time we could speak about the character of Rosh Chodesh a little bit. But there is a specific reality to this day. And the farmer would say, I can't plant on Tuesday, the bright day is Monday. For the physical. So the same thing in the spiritual. Any questions or comments on this so far? You with me, Abe?
Yeah, 100%. Was Lot so into, we learned so much about him, his character wasn't exemplary, actually.
Right.
Yeah, you said he did it on a...
Either because he could have been informed by Avram. I don't know if it's his spiritual character or his relation with Avram Avinu. I don't know. Okay, so what's Hanukkah all about? Well, Hanukkah has to bother us, actually, because you got to get into the minds of the Jewish people in the time of the first 900 years or so after the giving of the Torah. They celebrated Pesach, matzahs like us. They had Shavuos, reliving the giving of the Torah, tapping into that frequency. They had Rosh Hashanah and the Shofar and Yom Kippur and the fast and Sukkot and the Sukkah and the Lulav and Esrog. When they put away the Sukkah, that was the end of the holidays for the year. They had no Hanukkah and they had no Purim. These holidays didn't exist. If we've learned that a holiday is here in order to arouse us to a certain aspect of our spiritual potential, a certain aspect of our relationship with Hashem, and maybe I didn't state that clearly enough, that Pesach we're supposed to focus on being free, freeing ourselves from the things that we've held ourselves back based on. Purim, we're supposed to see the hidden hand of God in all of our lives, and how He's been guiding us all along. And on and on. Yom Kippur, we know what that's about. It finds its roots in the Hashem forgave the Jewish people when they sinned in the golden calf, and it always has forgiveness in it. Whatever Hanukkah's about, whatever it's about, did not apply to Moshe and David HaMelech, King David. Didn't apply to all of those generations. Whatever its lessons are, these were irrelevant lessons to Jews who lived before Hanukkah happened. In other words, if the sages established for us a yontif so that we might mine it for its potential, they didn't need to mine it. Its potential is unique to us. You know what I'm saying? This is something I heard from my Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yaakov Weinberg, my wife's grandfather, that I heard him say this many times. In yeshiva, he always spoke on the first night of Hanukkah. We had a Hanukkah party in yeshiva, and he always spoke. He spoke about this year in, year out. That the lessons of Hanukkah are lessons that are for the Jew in exile. Because they applied only in those generations that were leading into exile and all the way till now. Their lessons didn't apply before. So whatever their lessons are, you see, the timeless lesson of matzah was timeless. It happened even before. But the lessons of Hanukkah must not have been applicable before. So we have to understand what the lessons of Hanukkah are to the Jews like us who live in this exile. At the root of the Hanukkah is an argument between the Greek culture and the Jewish culture. And the Greek culture and the Jewish culture are extremely similar. Probably, it could be said probably that more than any other culture, the Greek culture is closest to Judaism. That could be argued. Closest, but not the same. Tragically different. You know, I have an identical twin brother. So within the family, people see us as so different. Outside the family, people see us as so the same. You know, depending on how close you are, you see, accentuate the difference, or you accentuate the similarities. So there are great similarities between Greece and Yisrael, and there are great differences. The Greek sees man in the center of the world. And he's almost right. Because man is almost in the center of the world. Man has to take responsibility for the world, has to care for the animals. The greatest among us would never tear out a leaf from a tree just for no reason. He has a responsibility to bring the world to its potential. Man is very, very great, but he's not the center of the world. The center of the world is Hashem, is the Creator, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. And they thought that because man was so much greater than the animal kingdom, that man is the center of the world. Now let's explain this, because this is really important and has its roots actually in the three children of Noah. Noah from the flood, he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafes. Shem is the forebearer of the Jewish people, Avram. Ham is the barbaric one who reveals his father's nakedness. And Yefes is sort of the sidekick of Shem. He comes along with Shem to cover up the father. And he's the forebearer of Yavan of Greece. Yavan is a son of Yefes. And when Noah sobers and he gives a bracha, to two sons and he gives a curse to one. And he says to Yefes, the youngest son, who's the forebearer of Greece, Yaft Elokim Yefes v'yishkon be'ohol Hashem. May God bring beauty to Yefes that will reside in the tents of shame. The main thing will be the tents of shame. But Yefes will have a place in that. Ham has no place in that. Ham is bad. Ham is a barbarian. Ham is the physical monster. Yefes is much more cultured than Ham. But Shem is the top. Shem is the Jewish people. The Greek respected the idea that man should not be all about the body, should not just run after his temptations, should not just be a monster, should not just be part of the physical world. You see, it's very interesting. I took biology in high school, and in advanced placement biology and AP biology, we dissected a fetal pig. Not because we wanted to learn about pigs. The purpose was to learn about people. So, isn't that startling? That there's enough to learn about people by looking at the pig? That the physical properties are so similar? Right? Arthur, what do you say?
We dissected a worm.
Yeah? Nothing more than a worm? No, so I did a fetal pig. I guess I should feel great about that.
No, I'm just trying to connect. Like, what was the point of dissecting the worm?
The mice, the rats take center stage.
I did a cat.
And what was the purpose?
the same organs. We have the same organs.
Right. In other words, you could look at the world. You could look at the world and say, man is part of the animal kingdom. And of course, I don't want to get into a whole philosophical discussion, but that's how Darwin looked at the world. That man is just a member of the animal kingdom, more advanced maybe, but just a member of the animal kingdom.
The Greeks reviled the body, sports, gymnastics. They built statues as gods. I mean, they were known for all their statues.
We're going to come back to that. Because it sounds like what I'm saying is in contrast to that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we're gonna
they idolized the physical.
So we're going to come back to that. We're going to come back to that. Very important question. What the Greeks were all about is the power of science and the power of wisdom. The incredible possibility of intellectualism. That sounds like secular Jews. Right? It's fair. In other words, what the Greeks did, which was beautiful, is that they said the body should not be in charge, the mind should be. Mind should be the most revered over body. But there's a third choice besides mind and body. Man is not simply made up of mind and body. Man's not just a fetal pig with a mind or an ape with a mind. And that's what Darwin believes. Man is an ape with a mind. Man is an ape. I mean, I don't agree with that any, but let's just argue that it looks like an ape. With a mind and a soul. And Klal Yisrael stands for the idea that the soul is on top, not the mind. It's true that man is better than animals, and man is great. But greater than man is that portion of man that we call Chelek Elokam Mimal, a portion of God from above, called the Neshama, the soul. The soul has to be the leader of who we become. Now, yes, the soul's invisible. Yes, the soul is not, you know, you can't bring him into the laboratory and dissect him. But the soul is the captain of the ship. They were great for thinking the mind was the captain of the ship. Everybody before them thought, you know, man is just a dog. Survival of the fittest. You know, just attack. They did refine man in a beautiful way. That's the difference. I believe you can describe the difference between Shem, Ham, and Yafes, the three sons of Noah, as he who represents Shem is the soul. Ham is the body, revealing his father's nakedness. And Yafes is the mind. And the truth is that we bear a great similarity to those people who believe in intellectualism over simply, you know, brute strength or savage greatness, barbarian cultures. They refined mankind, Greece. And we believe in the refinement of man. We agree with that. That's precisely why the Greek culture is such a great threat to the Jewish people. My father was fond of saying when I was a kid, it's easier to tell the difference between black and white than black and gray. You know, we're not into the barbarians. We're a bunch of weak Jews, you know. We don't want to get into those fights. But the thirst for intellectualism is awfully tempting. But intellectualism, till this day, denies God. Thousands of years. Till this very day, it is the environment of intellectualism that is the most anti-God in the world. I would go so far as to say that I think the barbarians are more, a bigger believers in the Almighty than the intellectuals. Because the intellectual believes in the power of man. And look at how great man is. And man is great. Let me tell you something. I'm amazed. Do you know that man, in the last 110 years or so, has learned how to make metal with hundreds of people standing on it go up into the air and fly like a bird. It's called an airplane. Mesmerizing. We're being taped right now. It used to be, if you wanted to be taped, you needed like a big reels. And then you needed a tape. My cell phone is taping us. It's unbelievable. This machine, I don't know how to use most of it, but it might be able to make dinner. Not sure. It's unbelievable.
It's got a microwave component in
it. Yeah, it's unbelievable. So look at what man can create. Man is unbelievable. But man can't explain everything. Man cannot explain even how to find happiness. Really. In other words, there's no greater model for true happiness. Again, this is a conversation for another time, but there's no greater model for true happiness than Torah. In all those ivory towers where they're all figured it all out, have they all figured out how to, you know, bring into the world progeny who love them and fulfill their dreams and live content lives filled with touching special things? I don't want to generalize, but I'm not convinced. Let's leave it at that. And so there's an element like the existence of Klal Yisrael, that the Jewish people continues to exist against all odds, even though we haven't been home together for thousands of years. Even though we've been hated everywhere we go. Our perseverance, not our perseverance, our Hashem's perseverance, that we are still here. You can't explain that in a laboratory. The intellectual wants so badly to prove the point that man is so great that he's obsessed with criticizing and working on destroying a notion of God. With all the biblical criticism there is out there, why not just throw the book out? After all, look at all the volumes of claim it's ridiculous. So if it's ridiculous, get rid of it. Maybe it's not so ridiculous. With all the, most of the time science will not accept a theory for so many generations. It has to be proven. Scientists are always looking to prove things. How come they still subscribe to the theory of evolution? Because the danger of believing that there is a creator means that I have responsibilities to someone else. I don't want to have responsibilities to someone else. I don't want to have to be told what to do. Man's in charge. So you have the world of intellectualism striking at the notion of God all the time. And it's been the biggest enemy that God's had for the last couple thousand years, is the world of the intellectual. Now don't be confused. I'm not saying reject it all. We're going to get into how the Jew has to embrace it. The same way he embraces the mind over the body, but he has to embrace it with the soul over the mind over the body. Now let's go to why they worship the body. Worshipping the body is only a form of worshipping man. It's man drawn out to his greatest potential that they worship. Because the greatest conception they have in the world of what there can be is great man. And so they worship the mind and the body of man. And look at what man can do. And the Olympics come from there. And the art. And the forms of art of man. I mean, how come they don't have any embarrassment about that all of history people are wearing clothing since the Garden of Eden. But they didn't. I don't know if they did or didn't when they were alive. I'm just not sure. But their art is, in bold display of
the whole Olympics. Everyone was naked.
Yeah. Yeah.
They went to gymnasium always without any clothes on. They were known for that.
Yeah. So
they wanted a perfect body.
Right. They're incredible yearning for how man is the greatest. Do you know what flies in their face in the biggest way? And that's why one of the first things they outlawed. The mitzvah of circumcision. The mitzvah of circumcision says that man as he is created is less than perfect. He's not that great. There's work to do. He needs to subscribe to a spiritual notion over the physical notion. That's what we're saying. in a bris. That's why Hitler, Yimach Shemo, may his memory be erased, was against circumcision too. He wrote in Mein Kampf that the Jews have afflicted mankind with two great wounds, conscience and circumcision. He was onto this. Circumcision represents that we are not simply physical. We don't believe that it's just what you see is what you get. Man, as he comes out from his mother's womb, is perfect. No, you got to work. You got to strive for physical, spiritual things. So, you know, the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah that the Greeks were the first ones to want a translation of the Torah. You know, the Septuagint, the translation of the 70, the time of Talmai, the king. Why does a Greek want the translation of the Chumash, of the Torah? The answer is that they were truly thirsty for wisdom. And they still are. And true thirst for wisdom is very similar to our people. And that's part of the bracha that Noach gave his son Yefes from the beginning. You will be like, very similar to Shem. But in nuances, it's different. And the enlightenment is the term for the realization of how powerful mind can be. You don't just send your kid out to work because he's got physical labor attributes. Imagine what good he can become if you give him a chance to study. And the enlightenment was always Jewish people fought the enlightenment. In truth, those who became enlightened, so to speak, and in huge numbers became distant from Torah and were lost to the Jewish people. And in the very first verse, second verse of the Torah, it says, "V'ha'aretz ha'isa tohu vavohu v'choshech al pnei tohom." And the land was tohu vavohu, sort of chaotic. There was darkness on the horizon. The Medrash says that this darkness describes Greece. Choshech zu yavon. Darkness is Greece. They darkened the eyes of the Jewish people. Ironically, enlightenment has caused more darkness than just about anything. More Jews have been lost to the enlightenment in all likelihood than to the sword. Because the enlightenment, when you learn these philosophy and science and all of that, and you see how great man can be, it's risky. Because man can lose himself there. Can lose himself. This is hard to describe because it's so nuanced, really. Because we so do believe in education. But we know that you have to know the danger of becoming part of their society. The danger of becoming part of their society to the end degree of what they want out of society is for man to become so wise as to reject the idea that there is anything above him and to lose his way and to not serve his creator. And the irony is that the service of the creator is that which leads to the happiness and that which leads to the endurance of man and of a character and of morality and goodness. Look at what's happened in this country. Are we a more moral people than we were 50 years ago? Mm-hmm. We're more moral or less moral?
Less moral.
Or clearly less moral.
It's not even close.
It's not even close. No. But there's more. There's more scientific advancement. There's more people getting higher education. There's more greatness achieved, and yet the decay of the society is evident from what was acceptable on broadcast television in 1990 versus 2010. Now that basically is most of the era that I haven't watched any of it, so I can't really know. But I can tell you that in 1980 to now, I mean, again, I don't watch it now, but I know what's going on. I'll give you an example of something I do know about. The magazine covers today in America, in the checkout aisle, a person shouldn't look at them. But it happens on occasion that I see that the discussion is often about celebrity pregnancy of unmarried people. I'm not talking about 65 years ago, when I was a little kid, that would have been controversial. That would have been what we call a shanda, embarrassment.
I remember that somebody got pregnant and we're not married at that time. When I was a kid, it was hush, hush. You didn't even talk about it.
Right.
I mean, it was just so
secret. But, and when I was a kid, again, only 25 years ago, there were names for women like that.
Yeah.
It was a cherpa. It was a shanda. Today, it's not like that at all. Totally public.
And the men who didn't.
And the men also, right?
There were names.
There were names for the men, right? There were names for the men. Yeah. It was a shanda.
Yeah.
Today, it's not on the magazine cover because of the scandal. It's on the magazine cover because it's not only okay, it's a virtue.
Right, and that's what sells.
What's going on here?
I think it became socially acceptable to have a child out of wedlock and just
for
couples to be living and never marry at all. It became socially acceptable to be living together for a long time, never marrying, having kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, they look at it and say, why divorce? Why marry? Because divorce is so expensive.
There was a recent study.
It's easier to.
40% of Americans say marriage is now obsolete.
Yeah, but they're so wrong. That's the thing I want to explain to you.
It's frightening.
They're so wrong. They're not asking themselves what will be with all those kids. Okay, what will be with the moral fabric of the average person? So in the same moment when you have newer and newer and newer antibiotics and better and better and better phones, it should translate, if Greece is right, to better lives. But it doesn't. Because it's tapping into the neshama that leads to better lives, not into the seichel. The soul, not the mind. And this is the war between Greece and Israel. Forever. This is what Hanukkah is really about. That we can be in an exile. Even, by the way, the story of Hanukkah happened when we were in Israel. You can be exiled people in your own land because of a philosophical exile where the whole world doesn't believe what you believe in. Where your oppressors want you to get rid of your connection to spirituality above all other things, to Torah and mitzvos and Hashem above all other things. They want you disconnected from that, detached from that. That's what the war is between the Jewish people and Greece. That's Hanukkah. When we fought back, we didn't fight back against people who wanted to kill us. We fought back against people who wanted to Hellenize us. And we're awfully Hellenized now. Basically, we dress like them. We love many of the same things that they love. Myself included. You know, I'm proud to say that over the years of my life, I've become less and less interested in many of the forms of American entertainment, but not completely disinterested, not even close. We love what they love. Even though it reinforces many of the wrong messages. And why would you tell a kid, you know, I love, and then finish it with a rock band or an outfielder? Why would you say to your kid, you know, in our family we love Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle is not something to love. Mickey Mantle, a baseball player in the 1950s and 60s. He was a man with a talent with a terrible drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
unbelievably controversial extramarital situations. Very fast, great arm, big hitter. That's what we love. And I'm telling you, we do love it. In other words, we really do love it. Let's be honest about it. We do. Because there is something to it. There's something attractive to it. But we have to be so careful that it doesn't become what we're about. Even more refined aspects of it. I'm not just talking about that. Even more refined aspects of it. An artist. A musician. And they're more refined. But they're not Gedolei Torah. They're not the revered Torah sages. You want to see refined. You want to see refined. You want to shake when somebody walks into a room. You know, there are people available to see what refined is. You know, I've witnessed many times Rabbi Avigdor Nevensol, the Rav of the Old City in Yerushalayim. The man doesn't pick his eyes up to see what's going on in the world because of the spiritual depravity of the world. The man uses his time for important things. Eats so that he's strong enough to serve God. Goes to sleep to serve God. Wakes up to serve God. Cries every night that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Holy Temple. I've seen him. I've seen the tears. As he looks out into the courtyard above on the Temple Mount. I've seen him shed the tears. That's character. That's character. That should be, you know, the longest Wikipedia page. The biggest story in the New York Times. But we get lost in a lot of things. And so Hanukkah is the time that we need to fight the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, to be one of them. We have to honor a Jewish uniqueness. That which is specifically Jewish. If you go to certain Jewish environments, or you read certain books and you talk about great Jews, there's an organization here in this city that has a big display of great Jews in our history. And what they mean by great Jews is people who happen to be Jewish, who were great at what the Gentiles view as greatness. Astronaut, you know, Judith Resnick was an astronaut. She died in the Challenger, you know. Comedian, movie maker, playwright, author. That's called great Jews. I'm not knocking those specific people. But we were not created to be the best Gentile nation. Or to be a nation like the Gentiles. I spoke about this a few months ago. It's a controversial talk in the shul. Is that I'm not convinced Israel should have an Olympic team. Wouldn't it be better if Israel would say, we're the Jewish people. We have different goals. We're busy. We're learning. Sorry, we cannot train somebody for his whole life to be a champion windsurfer. A Jewish boy is too precious to become a windsurfer and be a champion. It's too precious what he could, how he could connect to Hashem to wake up in the morning and concern himself with windsurfing. Isn't it really an embarrassment to our people that we have an entry in the Miss Universe contest?
Yeah.
Undermines our values.
Terrible busha. You with me? It's a spiritual busha for all of them, probably.
I don't know that word.
Embarrassment.
Embarrassment.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's... we should look at the world and say, that's horrible. We can't participate. I'm sorry. We're not available for the no... for the improperly clad event. We're not available for it. We don't believe in that stuff. That's what we ought to be. Hanukkah is the time that we focus on that. Hanukkah, what's in this time, is our ability to strengthen our primacy of Torah in our lives. Yes, we're people who use the iPhone and get on airplanes and go to and you know, read secular books and maybe even go to universities. But no, we're not one of the nations of the world like everybody else. There's the 70 nations of the world and there's Klal Yisrael. And we have our character and we're going to subscribe to what we are supposed to be. That's what we're going to do. We're going to raise our kids to be great Jews. Not meaning great playwrights who happen to be Jewish. Great Avdei Hashem, great servants of God. That's our goal. Primacy of Torah. Soul over mind and body. Not just mind over body. Soul over mind and body. That's the Jewish people. So in the class, we spoke about... in the class title, we spoke about winter. So I'm going to touch on that topic, winter, for a second. There are two winter holidays, Hanukkah and Purim. They're really very different than the summer holidays. Well, let's say like this. The Jewish, I would say it's winter. We're gonna contrast summer and winter. Spring and fall are hard to deal with. We're going to call half the year spring, half the year summer, and half the year winter. And it's still true that Purim happens almost always before the vernal equinox, when the nights are longer than the days. Yeah? Okay. You with me? Mm-hmm. So the light half of the year contains Pesach, Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. And the dark half of the year contains Hanukkah and Purim. This is not coincidental. This corresponds to the light portion of history and the dark portion of history. There was the light portion of history when the Jewish people had revealed miracles all the time, splitting seas, miracles in the temple. This topic is a bigger topic than I can get. It's more of a Purim topic than a Hanukkah topic, but it's important here. But we used to live like in a time of prophets. People who talked to God, people who went to the Beis HaMikdash and asked the Kohen Gadol what we should do in war, and his breastplate lit up to tell them the answer. Direct contact with the beyond us. Today we live in a very dark time. We feel like we're just one of the nations of the world. We don't know what to do with the Israeli-Palestinian problem. We don't know how to handle things. We don't know what we do. We can't get turned to the prophet. We don't see revealed miracles. We have to see the hand of God in a six-day war. We have to see the hand of God in 39 Scud missiles missing, killing anybody. We have to see the hand of God in our own lives when we have a difficulty that leads to family coming together and that leads to connection. The holidays that happened historically in the form of a winter style happened in the winter. And their observance is in the half of the year that's winter, and in what I would call a winter style. This is what I mean. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuos, these are yontif, not allowed to perform all the prohibited labors, driving, whatever. Yeah? Hanukkah is a regular day. In fact, many people will bemoan Hanukkah. My father-in-law spoke of this. Like, always, Hanukkah is hard because, you know, yeah, we light the candles, and hopefully we go to shul in the morning and we say Hallel. But does it feel like a holiday in the middle of the day? If you're working on yourself, it does. But for most people, I would say not. For most people, it feels more like December 7th than Hanukkah. On Rosh Hashanah...
you got a constant reminder. Every night you light that candle. It's a constant reminder.
It's a reminder, but not much more than a reminder. I'm with you. Mm-hmm. It's a reminder. Is it like Yom Kippur? You don't need a reminder. It's Yom Kippur. On Rosh Hashanah, which doesn't have the fast... You don't need a reminder. It's all days of Rosh Hashanah. Even every Shabbos. You don't need a reminder. The Friday night candles don't remind you it's Shabbos. And then Havdalah reminds you that it was Shabbos. It's Shabbos the whole time. You feel Shabbos. That's all its rules. Shabbos has rules. Hanukkah's missing all that. The lesson here is like this. That the miracles of the salvation of the Jewish people through these dark times, our close similarity to the nations during these dark times, the fact that it truly is a dark time. This morning the sunrise was at 7:17 and the sunset was at 5:19. That means that there's 14 dark hours and 10 light hours. This dark time also comes with observances where Hashem says to us, Be with me in your regular days. Be with me in your regular lives. Because this is your challenge. Hanukkah's challenge is while you are at your job built on science. While you are in your life of great similarity to Greece. When it's Shabbos and Yom Tov, you pull out of this world, of the world we live in, and you go into your Jewish world. On Hanukkah, you don't have the opportunity to pull out of your Jewish world. You're in your everyday world. And it's saying, yeah, have a computer. Take advantage of that. I worked on the computer for hours today. Take advantage of the computer. And use it to sanctify God's name, not, God forbid, to get distant from God. On Hanukkah, it's engage in all that regular stuff. Go to work. But take Hanukkah with you. Take, again, maybe more than any other day, this is about nuance. About a hair's breadth difference in a certain sense between what it is to be an iPhone user and an iPhone worshiper. What it is to be a person who works out in order to perfect man versus someone who works out in order to perfect the service of God and be healthy. Hanukkah is our time in our regular lives. In the winter, meaning, so to speak, the dark, less spiritually lit time, which is literally in the winter of the year and in the winter of history during the exile. If you divide all of history in half, between the light time when we were riding high in the land of Israel, Solomonic era, and the dark time that we're in this long exile. And it's also the style that we have it. And all this is found in these days. All this stuff is found in the character of the fact, let's review. The fact that time is a revisit to the potential of that time. Not simply a commemoration of something that happened. And that Hanukkah is a time that we focus on in our regular wintry lives. That we focus on the nuanced difference between a people that believes that body isn't everything. We agree with those people. They believe that mind is greater than body. There's a nuanced difference between those who believe in the soul's primacy and the Torah's primacy. And those people who believe in the body's primacy, mind's primacy, they ultimately lead themselves to being all about man, all about their own service. And what you see is what you get, and if you can't see it, it's ridiculous. If you can't find it, if you can't reproduce it in a lab, it's ridiculous. It's archaic and prehistoric and farcical and opiate of the masses and a crutch. It's their world, and there's our world, which is that cleaving to Hashem is why man was put in this world. And all the utensils that Greece brings should be used. As Noach said, the beauty of Greece should be found in the tent of shame. So our job is to be people of the tent of shame, to be people of the Jewish character who also take advantage of all that Greece provides the world, but who testify about the light of life. I want to add one more thing because I remember that I wrote down before. This also is symbolized in fire. Fire is a very interesting thing. In one sense, it's extremely physical. But in one sense, it's very transcendent over the physical. It's obviously physical. It has temperature to it. But it doesn't have shape. You can't hold it. It has no shape. It flickers. And what amazes me is that when you see somebody light, and you might want to check this out tomorrow night and the last night, if your menorah casts a shadow on your wall, perhaps because of the incandescent light, or now fluorescent light, in your room, and you've got a menorah casting a shadow, you'll notice that when you light your Hanukkah candles, the shadow remains the same. Even though you put something new on top of the candle, it's not evident in the shadow. Now this is obviously because it's light, so light's not going to cast a shadow. Follow what I mean? In other words, the flames themselves cast no shadow. So in the one sense, you did something new, and there's something physically going on here. And in the other sense, yet, if you're only looking at the shadow for evidence of what exists in this world, apparently it doesn't exist. Follow me? I think that light, fire representing Torah, is partly in this vein. that yes, it's in this world, but it defies characterization as part of this world. The fire is like the soul. It's in this world, but you can't quantify it. You can't measure it. You can't say it starts here and it ends there, and this is how big it is, and this is how small it is, and then it's cast shadow on the wall like everything else casts shadow on the wall. No, it speaks to a certain sublime quality that it's different, it's elevated, it's spiritual. It's like spiritual while it's still physical. That's us. That's the Jewish people, have to be spiritual while still physical.
Fire.
The Greek is only physical. But we speak to the idea that there's a soul in the world. So hopefully we'll use the last what do we have? 40 hours? 44 hours of Hanukkah left. About 44 hours of Hanukkah left. That we can use it to tap in, to make decisions about how we're going to live lives that are Jewish above all else. That take advantage of the physical, take advantage of this wonderful country in which we live, but we never become people who are just parts of the nations of the world, but with our unique Jewish character. Okay, we'll stop here.
It's this time of the year, it's so good when it comes.